This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville. It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host, Matt Schaefer-Powell. The Office of National Drug Control Policy calls it the nation's fastest-growing drug problem. The CDC calls it an epidemic, and the Partnership for a Drug-Free America calls it a national tragedy. We're talking about prescription drug abuse. It's a problem that's grown exponentially over the last decade, and its wake is littered with broken families and broken lives. Today on Dialogue, we're wrapping up our series on prescription drug abuse by looking at the problem, its causes, its effects, and what can be done about it. Got a great panel assembled today, each with expertise in a specific area. Dr. Kip Wenger is Regional Systems Medical Director for Team Health at the UT Medical Center. Amy Gallion is the Program Director of the Blount County Drug Court. And Webster Bailey is Clinical Outreach Director at Cornerstone of Recovery in Louisville. And I want to thank all of you for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
When we talk about prescription drug abuse, and Amy, let me start with you. When we talk about prescription drug abuse, what drugs are we generally talking about from a core perspective? What are the ones you're seeing the most references to?
We see pretty much a variety of all prescription drugs, but the ones that most of our participants are dealing with is you're talking about your oxys, your opiates. Morphine is one that we see quite often. But what you'll hear from our participants and the people that are coming through the court system is they're using whatever they can get their hands on.
Webster, what about you when people are checking into treatment? What are they reporting?
Really, several different opiates. Oxycontin being one of the most widely used, but also Roxacet or Roxycodone, as it's referred to. Some benzodiazepines. Xanax, those kinds of things, but those are usually kind of what I would say like gap fillers, you know, while they can't get their drug of choice, which is usually an opiate, a pain pill, then they're going to look for other things to help get them through the sort of the withdrawal symptoms, you know, and sometimes they'll even use Suboxone to really as just a way to get them from until it will cover them until they can get more of what their drug of choice is.
And real quickly, for those of us who don't know, Suboxone, how is that different from some of these other drugs that we're talking
about? Well, it's designed, it's being used several different ways right now. One of the ways that it's being used is through what has been kind of recently referred to as medication-assisted treatment or medication-assisted therapy. And it's basically a replacement therapy. It's the idea that instead of having folks out looking for oxycodone, oxycontin, Roxacet, Percocet, whatever their drug of choice is that you provide them with a prescription to Suboxone, and it's a harm reduction model. So it's reduces harm on society.
Would methadone for a heroin addict be a reasonable analogy there?
Yeah, and methadone's also being used a lot by opiate addicts. Heroin is an opiate, and so it's the same type of drug. Dr. Wenger could probably comment on the different chemical makeup of the drugs, but it's the same idea. It's the harm reduction model.
Mm-hmm. And Kip, what have you seen in the emergency room over the last decade or so?
I mean, I think the drug of choice really is Roxycodone, as Webster's saying. That's what people really want. And sadly, I think one of the drivers in that is because it's not a compound medicine, meaning it doesn't have Tylenol in it. And what you see as people progress through the phases of addiction is they want that high that they had the first time. And unfortunately, they sometimes resort to injecting these drugs. And Roxycodone is a drug that is injected, as is morphine, as Amy's saying, and is very popular and has great street value. Because, I mean, we see the addiction, but we also realize that it's a business, too, to some extent on the outpatient. So if I get a prescription for narcotics, I may keep some and I may sell some. And that's really kind of I think in talking to patients, very frankly, I've had people confide that that's exactly what they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, earlier this week, we've been running a series on prescription drug abuse. And the woman that we, you know, featured this morning was telling me that very same thing. She would get a prescription. She would get 90 pills and sell half of them and take the other, you know, keep the other half
right,
and take them herself. Yeah. So that's not necessarily a rarity.
And I apologize, I did not hear the show this morning, but did she tell you what the street value is, for instance, for 90?
She did not, no.
So, you know, it's a function, it's kind of interesting because as we are starting now to work with law enforcement, we realize that as law enforcement does a better job, the street value goes up. It's a really an economic model, to be sure. But you're getting about a buck per milligram. So if you have 90 10-milligram Percocet, as an example of a drug, you know, you're looking at, you know, you can do the math. It's 900 bucks. You can do $1,000 easy.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you talked a little bit, Kip, about the high that they feel when they take it. What is it that people using these drugs are experiencing? What is it they're feeling that keeps bringing them back?
Oh, obviously, for clarification, this is the secondhand.
Sure, absolutely,
secondhand information.
That's
okay.
Very good clarification to make. Thank you.
But you know, and certainly there are some people, and I think you know, as Webster would attest to this, and he's much more expert on this, that are more addictive in terms of their personality. But the biochemical process is dopamine, and you know what I tell people, and I have an opportunity to interact with medical students and residents, is really what we're talking about here are two huge rewards. One is dopamine, and one is dollars. There are big dollars for, and you just look on the front page of the paper, in this business. And there's also the power of dopamine. Dopamine is involved in any of these reinforcement tracks in the brain. And this basically just floods your brain with dopamine when you take it the first time. And many of these folks are constantly searching for that first experience of elation, of euphoria, and often end up with horrible results, as you know. So
what you're saying is that the experience they have the first time is not the same as the second, third, fourth, fifth?
I mean, there are variables in obviously how much drug you took, but oftentimes that's the case. That they're not, they don't have the powerful, the incredible, overwhelming, powerful experience the subsequent times after that first elation exposure that they had, if you will.
Yeah, so it's we talk about this in treatment a lot. It's referred to a couple of different ways. Chasing the dragon is one of them. The other one is simply chasing the high, and it's exactly what Kip's talking about. That feeling. I had a patient. The way he described the first time he ever used an opiate and got high from it.
Mm-hmm.
This is powerful. He said it felt like my mother was holding me in her arms.
Wow.
And he said that's what I go after. Every single time I use, I want that feeling of my mother holding me in her arms again.
You know, that is actually something that as we were producing this series, we kept running into is the person who said, the first time I took it, I was hooked. And I was thinking about my own experience. And a couple of years ago, I had a surgical procedure. The doctor sent me home with maybe 4 hydrocodone. And I took one and had never taken anything like that, took it and said, wonder what the big deal is. For some reason, and believe me, I'm thankful for this, I didn't have that response to it. In Kip, maybe you can shed some light on this, or Webster or Amy. You know, why is it that it affects some people one way and other people another way?
I mean, I can tell you what I have been taught in school was that, you know, if you use these drugs for prescribed medical indications, an acute painful condition, a broken bone, for instance, your likelihood of addiction, at least if it's used in a short-term and controlled way, is much less than if you use it, for instance, with the sole intent of getting high. That is, you don't have some painful condition that you're trying to treat. You're just taking it for sheer recreational use. I don't know that I understand the science of that, if that really, in the end, makes sense. But certainly, anecdotally, I've heard that a lot, and people do teach that out there.
Mm-hmm. I'll jump in and say our medical director at Cornerstone does a really good job of presenting the disease concept of addiction. And one of the things he talks about is that our dopamine reward system that we have as human beings, and that the addict's dopamine reward system is different than the non-addict's dopamine reward system. And so the way that drug interacts with their body is different. And so that's why, for one person, they take it and they almost feel that like they're being held in their mother's arms, or they feel hooked from the first time. And the other person takes it and it's like, yuck, you know, I don't want anything to do with that. It makes me feel nauseous or sick or whatever. So I think it has something to do with our dopamine reward systems being different.
Amy, are you seeing that kind of thing? I mean, are you seeing those same sorts of reports from people that are going through the drug court?
We do, but a lot of things that another side of that I think you got to look at is prescription meds. When people are in the addictive part of that, the sickness of not having it, once they start coming off their high, the pill sickness, as they'll refer to, is a very painful, the withdrawals from that are very profound. And so then it becomes an issue of they take the pills to keep from the sickness.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
there's also the flip side of that. It's part of it's chasing the high, and part of it is just trying to outrun the sick feeling that they have when they're coming down from that.
And I remember in middle school learning the difference between a psychological addiction and a physical addiction, and these we're talking about physical addiction here.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah.
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 Can I just jump in a little bit on this whole dopamine thing? You know, one of the issues that we don't really hear a lot about is about neonates. So that if you have a mother who is pregnant with a child and she's taking these opiates, we know that the fancy term for this is downregulation of opiate receptors. So we don't know what happens to these childs. A child that is born of a mother that is addictive, we don't know what that child's going to be like down the road. And the implications, I think, are really scary for us down the road. We just don't know. It's too early. So this idea that if you bathe your brain in opiates, that the beta dopamine receptors themselves actually reduce or at least are less effective. And that fancy term for that is downregulation of dopamine receptors. That's a big deal, and that could have huge implications down the road.
I mean, what we're talking about is potentially all these children that are being born addicted, chemically dependent on medications. They're essentially addicts from birth. There is no incubation period for the disease at 10 years old when they're having their wisdom teeth pulled and they're given pain pills. Boom. Addiction released immediately all over again. So
pretty scary stuff.
Incidentally, we also talked about that this week over at East Tennessee Children's Hospital and the program that they have there for babies who are born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. And Carla Saunders, who was is the nurse practitioner there, a nurse practitioner there, was telling me the other day they had 39 babies in there with NAS. And say 5 years ago, that number would have been one or two.
Yeah.
Right. And so that shows you right now, you know, very, very clearly what kind of increase we're seeing right now, you know, at this point in time. Over the last decade, it's just gone. Kip and I were talking on the phone yesterday, and if you look at a chart that shows some of these indicators, whether it's prescriptions being written or emergency room reports or admissions at treatment, if you look at the graph, it just goes straight up over the last. What do you think is contributing to that huge increase? Amy, do you have any thoughts on that?
The increase of the just
the fact that over the last decade we're seeing so much more.
I just think it's a lot the availability. I mean, you are seeing prescription drugs on the rise. People can get their hands on prescription drugs so much easier. I mean, you can go to the medicine cabinet. You can go, you know. Down the street. It's not hard to get your hands on prescription meds. It's an easy way to take care of your addictive habits. You don't have to go look into the corner dealer to find what you're looking for. You can find that at home.
And I would imagine that's also something that makes it so hard to get our arms around as a society, is that we're dealing with something that is, in its at least original form, it's a legal drug. It's in that what separates it from something like cocaine or meth or heroin, which are the street drugs.
Sure.
Here, its original intent is that it's a legal drug.
Right.
And I think, sadly, that perception goes through and people say, well, it's a prescription drug, therefore it is safe.
Right.
And obviously that's not true. These drugs have great indications for folks. It really had a great intent. But unfortunately, if you look in Knox County alone, there are over 40 pain clinics in Knox County alone.
Right.
I'm not trying to indict, and I just want to clarify this, mm-hmm. that there are legitimate pain clinics out there. Unfortunately, the majority of pain clinics, in my opinion, are not that. So,
right.
But there are a lot of illegitimate pain clinics that make huge money off of this, and just look at the front page of the paper today.
Sure.
Yeah. For me to weigh in on it, what I think contributes to it is look at the drugs. There are five behavioral stages to the disease of addiction, and the experimental stage is the first one. It only accounts for the first or second time that someone uses a chemical. After that first or second time, then it's a choice to become a normal user, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're beginning to see prescription drugs being included in those experimental drugs, where 10 years ago, not as much. It was more alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, those kinds of things. But due to availability, I think public perception of you know, or the maybe they're less harmful because they are prescription drugs, that kind of a thing. That sort of a mentality is leading our young adult population to experiment with these drugs at an earlier stage in the disease model.
For somebody who's prescribed these drugs, again, maybe you've had a surgical procedure, maybe you're having pain, and I think it's worth noting that there are people out there who have a lot of pain that they're dealing with, and this is one of the ways this is one of the options for pain management. For folks like that who are taking these meds as prescribed, how do they know when they've sort of they're crossing that line between use and abuse?
That's a difficult line to understand where you are in relation to it, because if you look at the I'm going to refer again to the behavioral stages of addiction. All regular users of any substance, whether it be alcohol, so when I'm talking about those who take their prescriptions as prescribed, as directed, technically, by the behavioral stages model, they're actually in stage two of the addiction process. They don't progress past that. Really what happens, in my eyes, coming from a treatment perspective, is it really has a lot to do with consequences. When someone begins to have negative consequences as a result of their use and they continue using in spite of those consequences, that's the red flag to be looking for. The trick is those consequences, the addict is in denial at that point. And mm-hmm. So when they're late to work and their boss is on their case, the addict is unable to draw the connection between their prescription drug use or their or any chemical abuse. They're unable to draw the connection between them not sleeping well because of on meds or staying up late drinking. They don't see how that translates to morning and being hungover and showing up. So they're unable to see that. So it's a difficult process.
We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Today we're talking about prescription drug abuse, and we want to hear your story. How has your life changed because you or someone close to you was or maybe still is abusing prescription drugs? Of course, we also have a great panel of experts here to take your calls if you have a question or another comment. So tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050, and this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, back with my guests, Amy Gallion from the Blount County Drug Court, Webster Bailey from Cornerstone of Recovery, and Dr. Kip Wenger from the UT Medical Center. We're talking about East Tennessee's prescription drug abuse epidemic, and we want to hear from you. You can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, or you can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And Bob is calling from Oak Ridge. Bob did call us, and... Bob, you're on Dialogue. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call today. And I'd also like, this is Bob Stubblefinrock, to say hello to Webster and to Dr. Wenger. I've met him a couple of times and think highly of both their works.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
Now, Bob, you are the name of the organization. You're with an organization called Second Chance. Is that correct?
Correct. Second yep. Chance and Faith. We're combined faith-based counseling with a traditional counseling like Cornerstone does to address men with addiction.
What kind of things are you seeing, Bob?
It was real interesting today. They were talking about the neonates and the exposure to the opiates while they're in the a person's in the womb. I've got currently one young man whose mother and father were both addicted, and mother was prescription medication. His very first drug of abuse was Roxasets at age 10, and he was just gone. He was just totally addicted right from the get-go.
Did he get the Roxaset from his parents? I mean, is that the assumption?
He stole it from his mom and dad.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty common thing. I've got another young man whose mother was abusing Lortabs during her pregnancy, and he went from smoking a little bit of pot to opiates and was addicted just in a very short period of time. So we're seeing a lot of this with our young men that are coming in.
Well, Bob, thanks so much. I appreciate the call.
Thank you very much for having me today.
You bet. And Amy, you know, that's one of the things that I'm sure that you're seeing a lot in the Blount County Drug Court is you're seeing the generational kind of abuse. How?
You do see that. It is not the only thing that we see. I mean, that's one thing that I would like to just stress. Addiction hits all different genders, all different financial groups, all different socioeconomic. I mean, there's not just one area, but it is definitely, you will definitely see a generation. You'll see the pattern from one family member to another. It's something that you see very, very often. You'll see a whole family involved in addiction, and it's a real problem.
See, to me, that's shocking to hear that a 10-year-old kid got some Roxasset from his parents. I'm not involved in that
right area.
I mean, is that something that, is that shocking to you, or is that something that's part
what
of...
What I would challenge you to do is just to look in your medicine cabinet at home. I mean, you would be surprised the medications that we have at home. You know, well, lots of us, you'll have some type of procedure or whatever, and on the average, you may not take all those medications. Mm-hmm. You know, you may have, I know we talked about a wisdom tooth earlier, and you may have your wisdom tooth cut out, and you'll get prescribed 10 hydrocodone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the average, most of the time, you're not going to take all 10 of those. But then what happens with the rest of them? They get left sitting in the medicine cabinet, and it's just accessibility. So a 10-year-old that has accessibility to the medicine cabinet, either the family or grandparents or whatever, it's not hard to get their hands on it.
Yeah.
And I got to say, you know, one of the things that I also quiz residents and students on is what is the most commonly prescribed drug in this country right now? And you think about all the hypertension out there, all the diabetes out there, all the cholesterol issues. But by far and away, the number one most prescribed drug in this country is hydrocodone.
Really?
At over 130 million prescriptions. 130 million prescriptions. And, I mean, I don't know how to quantify that. You know, if you look at the number, and it's in tons.
Yes.
We produced 234 tons of hydrocodone equivalent last year. 234 tons. I mean, that's crazy.
Well, one of the statistics we were talking about this week is that in the state of Tennessee, there are 51 hydrocodone pills prescribed for every man, woman, and child over the age of 11, I think, or maybe it's 12. So as I'm thinking, I know they weren't prescribed to me and
either.
I know they weren't prescribed to my wife.
Somebody
so that
mine.
Means somebody else is getting part of this 51. And, you know, you mentioned in this country, is this exclusively an American problem?
It's largely an American problem. I mean, it really is. If we produce and utilize over 90-some percent of all of the hydrocodone, oxycodone equivalents out there. So, yes, I mean, there's addiction problems obviously everywhere, but mm-hmm. in this country, it is really unique.
Let's go back to the phones, 974-5050, 974-5050. If you have a question or a comment or you'd like to tell us one of your stories, Jackie is calling from Knoxville. Jackie, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I had a question for the doctors. I broke my leg several years ago when I was expecting my first daughter, and I was prescribed Lortab for the pain, which lasted, you know, pretty much for the last 4 months of my pregnancy. And so I was taking Lortab for, you know, 4 months while my daughter was in utero. And I just wonder, I didn't have any addiction. I went off of it and, you know, she was fine. And nobody ever said anything to me about her having any sort of withdrawal symptoms. But, you know, how much at risk is she as a child who was born of a mother who was using it for prescribed reasons? How much risk does she have for developing some sort of addiction in the future?
I mean, that's a great question, Jackie. And, of course, the reality is I can't really quantify how much risk she has. But, obviously, you were prescribed that drug for a medical indication. 4 months is a relatively long time to use it, but you were able to come off it without, it sounds like, a lot of symptoms. So I think it is my opinion that you would do, you know, obviously you got away from it pretty well, and it sounds like you're probably not a very addictive personality, and that probably there's a genetic tendency for that as well, that, you know, I think that you're probably pretty safe, or your daughter's pretty safe, more importantly. I just think that whenever these drugs are utilized, the goal should be to try to reduce the amount over time. And when you are in a situation where you're taking drugs, especially when the need is a chronic need, if you have an acute broken leg, that's one thing. But if you have chronic pain, chronic fibromyalgia, and you are prescribed escalating, increasing doses of opiates, that's a formula for disaster that we see played out again and again and again. And that's a real problem for us and for public health.
Well, thank you very much for the call, Jackie.
Thank you so much.
What about somebody who does have chronic pain? And you quite often you hear about chronic back pain. I mean, what are some of the options for someone like that?
There are, you know, obviously non-opiate options. It's very easy for a physician to write a prescription. And most of us get into this business because we want to help people. And when you hand a prescription over, folks are happy. The perception is you're a good doctor. You've helped this person. And there are physicians out there that have a great deal of difficulty saying no. I mean, and there are times when the right thing to do is to say no. And doing a really thorough history on mm-hmm. potential for opiate addiction is not something that, frankly, physicians do, in my opinion, very frequently. They don't have time. They're rushed. And I think that's a really important part of the whole process, or should be.
Webster, what do you say to somebody who's been through recovery and mm-hmm. or might be in recovery and is dealing with some chronic pain or maybe acute pain? Maybe they've had an accident.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's something that we, as an organization at Cornerstone, had to address in a big way. We actually opened another business to help folks who aren't necessarily still in treatment but who are maybe in the recovery community. Locally, or there are a lot of people out there who just, for whatever reason, don't want to take medications. They want alternative or natural ways to treat these illnesses. And so we opened another business called Cornerstone Integrative Health Associates. And the idea is that we bring all sorts of different, we've got acupuncture, Reiki, massage, Rubenfeld synergy stuff. There's a whole lot of I call them alternative medicines. Mm-hmm. They're really like an Eastern philosophy. They've been around for thousands of years, but in our country, we don't really, as a culture, buy into that very well. It's I think in a lot of ways we've become what I call the microwave society. It's the here and now. Those treatments oftentimes take multiple visits, can take weeks or months to have an impact, and we are not really good at waiting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true.
So
let's go back to the phones. 974-5050, 974-5050. Sorry about that. David is on the phone from Knoxville. David, welcome to Dialogue.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've got an observation to make. I'm an adult, nearly 60 years old. And I've spent my whole life working in construction as a drywall hanger and finisher. And I've seen countless cases where guys have injured their backs, pulled their backs, gotten hurt. And it seems that it's just the generic response is they go away to the hospital, they get a prescription for these hydros and oxys, and that's the end of it. And it just seems that the general consensus amongst construction workers that I've talked to is that it's just cheaper for the insurance companies to prescribe these drugs that absolutely destroy people's lives than it is to do surgery. And I'd wonder if you could just comment and talk about that and the insurance company's involvement in this, because it does seem our whole medical industry is driven by the profit motive now rather than the way things used to be when I was young.
Excellent question, David. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Boy, that's a big one.
That's a tough one. Okay, here we go. So I'm gonna step into it a little bit. You know, one of the things that happens to hospital-based physicians, and it's a real change in terms of we call it the fifth vital sign, is what's your pain scale? And physicians in private, I think, will tell you that it's been probably more detrimental to healthcare than helpful. And that's, I feel bad saying that because I've seen poor, unfortunate little old ladies with broken hips who delay in getting their pain medicine. No one would want to keep that person from getting narcotic pain medicines quickly. On the other hand, everybody that comes in with pain has, on a 1 to 10 scale, a 10. And patient satisfaction is a very trended thing in healthcare right now. So physicians are basically told, if you don't have the best patient satisfaction, and that's perceived as, I need to write these opiates, I need to write these drugs, that you know, they're going to get dinged. They might even lose their job. And that's a fear that some folks have. That's unfortunate. And I, you know, obviously for people with back injury, surgery is for the minority of patients, you know, so I would disagree a little bit with David that, you know, that that's the issue, that they're withholding surgery. But there's certainly a strong interest on the providers in the emergency department to, in fact, write opiates and get the patient comfortable but out of their department and followed up, you know, hopefully rapidly.
How do you, in an emergency room, how do you separate, or how are you able to separate the folks who are there to get a fix and those who really are in pain?
It's an incredibly difficult problem, and you'll see, you know, I would much rather make the assumption that people are there for the right reasons and occasionally treat somebody that's there, as you say, for quote-unquote a fix, than not treat someone appropriately who's there with an acute episode of pain. But it's very, very, very challenging. Obviously, patterns of utilization of the emergency department and the drug database, the controlled substance database, which is out there in Tennessee, but truthfully is not utilized to the extent that it should be by medical professionals for a number of different reasons.
One of the things I always keep in mind, too, I go out and I do a lot of public speaking around these type of issues. And a lot of folks, I tell people, you know, you physicians catch a lot of heck from people because a lot of people think this is all your all's mess. And I assure them that this is not your mess. One of the things that I talk to them about because the story I hear over and over again is, someone might say, well, my son's hooked on these pills and it's that doctor. It's all that doctor's fault. And what I tell that individual is, look, that doctor is trained to believe that his patient is telling him the truth. That's what medical school's about. It's about listening to your patient, treating your patient. And so what I end up telling that woman or that man is that perhaps your child is who you need to be talking to about telling the truth to the physician about what's really going on. Because like Kip was saying, we know that there are patients going into doctors' offices saying, look, doc, if you want to get a good patient satisfaction survey from me, you will give me what I want. Or I will, you know, send in my little follow-up from the insurance company that you were a bad doctor, you were rude, you know, all these negative dings as you were talking about. So it's a growing issue.
Amy, I imagine in the drug court as well, you're hearing a lot of you have to have that skill of being able to separate the truth from fiction, and it's probably not always that easy.
It's never easy, but you know, we're on a little bit different situation at the drug court in the fact that they can't take any medication. If it's going to cross-react or possibly cause a positive result on a drug screen, they can't take it. They've got to figure out another method to deal with whatever the pain is. They can take anything over the counter as long as it does not cross-react on a drug screen, but there's no wiggle room in that. If it's a positive, it's a sanction, and
I would imagine
there's
though,
consequences.
They try. I mean, I think of when we've talked a lot in sports about steroid abuse over the last few years and how it's very rare for an athlete to step forward and say, yeah, I did it, and I did it to juice up. And you know, most of them say, well, I was taking a cold medicine or this. I mean, do you get a lot of that, people trying to excuse their way around a failed test?
Of course you do, but there is no excuse around a failed test, and that's what they know on the get-go. I mean, if you fail the test, then you fail the test, yeah. So, I mean, it's not really an option.
Let's go back to the phones, 974-5050, 974-5050. Bill is calling from Knoxville. Bill, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, sir. I've been watching a nephew down in Florida that says addiction is just sunken lower and lower, and now he's in prison. My brother and sister-in-law are basically destroyed. My angle is a little bit different from the insurance company angle.
What's that?
If such a large percentage of these products are being abused, why don't the manufacturers scale down production? Because that just makes it look like they don't care where they're going as long as they get consumed.
You can easily come to that conclusion, and I don't know the ins and outs of that, and that's a great question. Thank you very much, Bill. But it does seem like, well, if we're manufacturing this much, isn't that one of the more obvious, isn't that low-hanging fruit in terms of dealing with the problem?
I think it's more of it's a simple supply and demand issue. Go back to this is my own personal opinion. You look at the war on drugs. I don't believe our solution is to go out and kill all the cartel members all around the world, I don't think that solves our problem. I think what we have to do is focus on the demand issue here at home. And if we stop having the demand for these drugs, then the producers, they'll scale back just as a result of sheer economics. So
I'm not quite as optimistic as Webster. My fear is that we are basically wired to be dopamine lovers, and these drugs basically provide that satisfaction. And there's huge money in this business. So right now you can open up a pain clinic, an illegitimate pain clinic, as you know, and make $30,000, $40,000 per day. So they're making lots of money. The person that is at the pain clinic basically sells half, keeps half, gets a great buzz, and makes money in the deal. So I think, while I hear what you're saying, I really do think it has to be, we've been working and operating in silos for very long. The medical community, the law enforcement, the legislature, treatment. I think if we're going to fix this, we've got to come together, which is, you know, hard to do. They've tightened up rules in Florida. We heard a lot about these pill mills in Florida, and what's happened is it's driven a lot of business north.
I mean, should we take any kind of optimism from what's happened with tobacco over the last decade or so, from the sense that here in America, anyway, in terms of product being sold in America, the tobacco companies have been forced to take part in awareness campaigns and that sort of thing, and we're actually seeing tobacco use drop off some. I mean, is that possible that model could be used with pharmaceutical companies as well?
I suppose it's possible. I think tobacco companies they know they can fund all the prevention efforts that they want, or raise prices or allow taxes to be increased on tobacco, but the true tobacco addict, and tobacco is a really good way. I mean, it's a really good drug to use when you're looking at addiction, because how many people do you know say, I'll quit when it gets to $3 a pack? You know, right. That's just absurd. I'll never pay $3 a pack. And now they're paying $5 a pack,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? So, it's an addictive drug, and I think people will pay what they have to get it.
We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Today we're talking about prescription drug abuse, and we want to hear from you. How has your life changed because you or someone close to you was abusing prescription drugs? Of course, we have a great panel of experts here to take your calls if you have a question or comment. So you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or call us at 974-5050. It's 974-5050, and this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, back with my guests, Amy Gallion from the Blount County Drug Court, Webster Bailey from Cornerstone of Recovery, and Dr. Kip Wenger from the UT Medical Center. We're talking about East Tennessee's prescription drug abuse epidemic, and we want to hear from you. You can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. Now, we've talked a little bit about statistics, and at the beginning of the show, I mentioned that we're seeing prescription drug use has increased 400% in America over the last decade. What can we glean from that? I mean, obviously, we can look at that and say, "Wow, 400%—that's a lot."
I mean, as I kind of suggested to you before, I really think the statistics are just the tip of the iceberg, that there's so much more going on. And I say that anecdotally from my experience working in the emergency department. We know for a fact, based on the stats, that during the course of this one-hour show, at least four people in this country will die directly from the results of drug overdose. What we don't know is how many car accidents will occur directly as a result of opiates. And kind of like what Webster was saying before, I see these patients involved in single car accidents. I look at their drug list and I say, hey, do you think it's possible that some of the medications may have basically contributed to your accident? And they look me in the eye and say, absolutely not, doc. There's no way. And that's, to me, that's true addiction. That's what you were talking about before. Things like endocarditis, which sound kind of fancy, which is an infection in the heart, which we didn't used to see, you know, 30 years ago. We see, I'm not going to say daily, but very frequently in the hospital now from IV drug abuse. So you constantly insert needles in your skin. You're not necessarily very meticulous about cleaning your skin. All of a sudden, you have an infection in your heart. I know of five people that I've seen myself that have developed what's called an epidural abscess, where they have an infection around their spinal cord and become paralyzed as a result. When somebody comes in with those symptoms, the first question we ask is, what IV drugs do you use? How long do you use? And we ask them, look, honestly, be straight with us, because we know that's how you got it, because it's almost the only way you can get it right now.
When you tell them, look, be straight with us, we know what's going on here, I mean, you must still have people saying, no.
I think there's certainly people that are going to withhold that. But I think if you're in a room with a closed door and you say, look, I'm here to help you, I think you have a problem, you've got to be straight with me, that's a little bit different than, you don't use drugs, do you? You're not going to get the same. You're not going to get the same answer, obviously.
Well, one of the things you also look at too, and going back to I've mentioned it a couple of times, the behavioral stages of drug addiction. Someone who's using IV drugs, they're in stage 5 drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, when you approach someone who is in stage 5, they know they're an addict at that point. We have these natural. Someone doesn't experiment with putting a needle in their arm. It's a progression.
Yeah.
They get there because at some point throughout their drug use history, someone suggested it to them that, hey, instead of taking it, then you can snort it. And then after they snort for a while, someone suggests, well, hey, if you think that's good or if you think that will get you off quickly, let's try putting this in your arm. Let me show you how to do it. Usually by the time someone is shooting drugs, when I'm doing an assessment on an individual who comes in the door and they say, hey, I gotta have an assessment, my attorney said or my boss said or whatever, my wife said, you know, okay, let's talk about what's going on. Well, I'm shooting dope. Okay, assessment over.
Yeah.
You're in stage 5 drug addiction. You didn't end up there overnight. And they tend to get that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So I say all that simply to say that when someone ends up an IV drug user, by that point, they're usually willing to be honest. But someone who's in stage 4 drug addiction, they're still in denial. They're still thinking that they can do something about this by themselves, and this is not this issue is not bigger than they are.
I want to go to a call. Sheila has been waiting for quite a while patiently here on the line. But before we do that, I want to ask about this concept of going cold turkey or doing it by yourself. Before the show today, I spoke to one of our volunteers here at the station who was abusing prescription drugs, he said 10 years ago, and he just made the decision, you know, this is a bad decision for me. I'm going to stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible? Is that something that you wouldn't recommend?
It's very possible. What I would suggest is that he probably does not have the disease of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real difference in drug abusers and drug addicts.
Yeah.
And that's a real simple answer, and there's a whole lot of complicated stuff behind it. But he probably doesn't have the disease of addiction, or it's not so far down the behavioral stages model to where there's physical dependency issues, those kinds of things.
So if we're looking at somebody who's addicted and we're using this, you know, this approach of, well, just stop doing it, that's not going to work.
No, doesn't work.
Sheila, thank you so much for holding for so long. You're calling from Jefferson County, and welcome to Dialogue.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I found it interesting what you were just talking about the person that was able to just quit using cold turkey, and, you know, that's great for them. That never worked for me. I am in recovery. I have 3.5 years clean.
Congratulations.
I was addicted, as I learned more about the disease of addiction, I'm sure I was an addict a long, long time ago before I started having major consequences. And, with willpower and awareness of having a problem, was enough to keep me clean, I wouldn't have had a decade of, just self-destruction and drug use. I believe I'm truly an addict. But, I wasn't aware of it. And with alcohol and maybe marijuana and other drugs like that, the consequences weren't really bad enough for me to have that awareness that I needed to realize that I had that I was an addict and I needed to get clean. But, you were talking earlier about the pain clinics, the illegitimate pain clinics and whatnot. And, I started using hydrocodone for a legitimate pain problem early on in my addiction. But since I'm an addict and since maybe I'm wired that way or for whatever reason, I always needed more. And something about it being a prescription drug made it easier for me to stay in denial and made it easier for me to justify and rationalize my using. But finding a pain clinic and finding doctors who were willing, to allow me to manipulate them into giving me more and more and more, it put me in a path of self-destruction. I was using 400 milligrams of OxyContin a day, and I'm a small lady, I was using enough to kill me on a daily basis, and by the end of my addiction, I wanted to die. I had hurt everyone around me. I was hurting myself. I hated my life. But, the answer for me was treatment and a 12-step program and staying very active in that 12-step program. And, by the grace of God and the support of recovering addicts, that's what worked for me.
Sheila, let me jump in here real quickly and ask you a question. I think I heard you say that you didn't have any sort of dramatic consequences. Is that right? Did I hear you say that?
No, I didn't. The bottom that I hit may be different than some bottoms. I didn't mm-hmm. go to jail. I didn't lose my kids. A lot of things that some people around me have, that didn't happen to me. But the fact that I felt like I was a quote-unquote functioning addict, I took care of my kids and I worked, it just kept me in denial longer because the inward unmanageability was there. The financial ruin was there because, obviously, even though I found drug clinics, pain clinics that were willing to give me high doses, I always wanted more because as my disease progressed, I ended up buying them on the street and, selling things, stealing things, doing things that I never would have thought that I would do, everything that went completely against my morals and values.
Yeah,
just to get that next fix.
Sheila, thank you so much for calling and staying online and sharing your story with us.
Sure, thank you.
I want to jump real quickly to the next call because one thing that Sheila mentioned was this idea of identifying pain clinics and being able to separate the legit ones from the illegitimate pain clinics. Kate, you're calling from Knoxville, and welcome to Dialogue.
Hi.
Yeah, you have a question about identifying legit pain clinics.
Yes, I actually, this is kind of the monologue in my head every day, so I'm glad to have someone to talk to about it, but that's one of many questions. It's hard to choose what even to say. I believe that my husband is using a legitimate pain clinic. It was referred by our general practitioner, and we trust them, but it seems to have escalated to a point that is beyond our control.
Where is he in this conversation? I mean, is this a conversation that the two of you have had, or is this your observation?
Well, kind of both. It has escalated to the point where he's on so many different things that I can't keep track. I know that there's methadone and there's hydrocodone and there's oxy and all at the same time. And he's been told point blank that this will end him. He's not abusing them per se. They're being taken as prescribed, but still, I guess my question is the pain clinic doing right by us? And how do we sever that relationship? Where do we go from here? How is he going to get out of that?
Well,
Go ahead, Webster.
Yeah, let me jump in a little bit. I would suggest finding someone, maybe your primary care physician, sitting down, bring all of those pills you're talking about. Bring them all into one place and say, look, we're really confused. We're at wit's end. We don't know what's going on here. Help us sort through this. Here's what my husband's taking, and have him in the room too. Yes. He may or may not be willing to do that, but I think that this is where you, as a loving wife, need to help him get to the bottom of this. Sounds to me like you're in a pretty dangerous situation.
Right, and we have, the last time he went to a specialist, actually enlisted all the medications he was currently taking, the specialist picked up the phone and called the pain clinic to verify, because he was like, that's not normal. That's insane. But, you know, this has been going on for 2 years, and the pain that he's dealing with, they were told that there's no treatment. It's just pain management. But first of all, the pain doesn't seem to be managed. And, you know, we're looking at lethal doses, and for no reason, apparently. And can I throw out real quick, too, Mr. Bailey, you mentioned the other program that Cornerstone has with the alternative treatments that people could try, you know, to substitute for the pills. How financially accessible are those?
Well, they're pretty accessible. I want to give Dr. Winger a minute to comment on your stuff here, but I'll say they're accessible. The trouble is, a lot of insurance companies aren't recognizing these treatments, and so what we can't even file them for you with your insurance company. The best that can happen is that someone pays out of pocket for these services and then submits. We'll give you some paperwork to submit to your insurance company to try and be reimbursed. But I want to throw it here to Dr. Winger. He's got some comments for you.
Thanks, Webster. I mean, the one thing I might say is that if there was one thing to look for in a pain clinic, it would be to look for providers that are board certified in the specialty of pain. Unfortunately, that's very rare in this county, but they are out there. And you're looking for, and your goals have to be in tune, you know, and that you want to get reducing doses of medicines, not escalating doses of medicines. And the idea of biofeedback, physical therapy, and those kind of models, I think, is great, like you offered up at Cornerstone.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Well, Kate, thank you so much. Is there a web page or a phone number that Kate can call,
Kate,
to follow up?
Call me directly, 865-970-7747, and I'll help get you in touch with some folks.
Did you get that number, Kate?
Say that one more time. I'm sorry.
Tell you what. We're just about to wrap up the show here, Kate. We're going to put you on hold.
Okay.
And we'll get you that phone number. And if for whatever reason we disconnect, because you know I've got big thumbs here, if I accidentally disconnect, just call that number, 974-5050. Just call us back, and we'll make sure that you get the number you need. Is that all right?
Great, thank
okay,
you.
Okay, Kate, thanks so much for calling. And we talked about this before the show. I mean, this is one of those shows that could probably go on for 2 or 3 hours. It's such a big issue. It's such a big problem. But I want to say thank you so much to all of you. Amy Gallion from the Blount County Drug Court, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Webster Bailey from Cornerstone of Recovery.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Webster. And Dr. Kip Wenger from the UT Medical Center, thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You bet. Thanks also to Greg Hill, who ran the board and handled the phones today. And thanks to you for listening, calling, sending your questions. We simply cannot do dialogue without you. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our podcast page by the end of the day. Just go to WUOT.org and click on the podcast icon. Brandon Hollingsworth will host our next episode of Dialogue with an election wrap-up show on Wednesday, November 7th. We hope you'll join us then. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org. A listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.